Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Stephen Reed podcast. Today I'm talking with my friend Sam in the garden about gaming, the Army Reserves and rugby. I hope you enjoy. Welcome to another episode. I've got my friend Sam Smith in the podcast studio today, and the podcast studio actually consists of my back garden, which is lovely. Recording yet another episode in the sun, which we're very grateful for. And I'm really happy and excited to have Sam on the podcast today because he's actually one of my longest running friends, I believe. I can't remember how long exactly it's been that we've been friendly, but it must have been about year seven, was it?
I reckon a bit earlier. We went to the same primary
school.
Yeah, it's definitely been a while, mate.
And we got proper friendly around year seven when
proper friendly. Oh.
when we started Textiles. Playing PlayStation together. Yeah. And Sam's wicked at a Call of Duty.
My only talent.
No, you're a man of many talents. Yeah. You also played rugby throughout most of school. So did you still play rugby?
Yeah, I do still play. I was just going to say, just thinking about that, you mentioned Call of Duty. That's probably the best years of my life when you finish school at 3:30, meet your mates online, play for a couple of hours, blag your homework, and then go to bed for another day of it. Those were the days. I just think, especially like, Year 11, when the second Call of Duty came out, and all the everyone at school, I'm sure everyone in their sort of like early 20s can relate. Males probably more than the girls, but
I guess
Call of Duty was the thing back in the day.
Some ladies might have a little.
I miss those times. It's a bit hard being an adult now and doing grown up stuff, but
there's not that much time I find now to come home and play video games.
And I suck. My reaction time is...
Do you actually?
No, I'm not that bad. But not as good as I was.
I think I've still got it, to be fair. I do. I go on these games like every so often just for a bit of fun. Especially like I did this winter because there's not a lot to do when it's dark outside. And I just hop on and have a game and you end up like absolutely owning all these guys who've been playing obviously, like non-stop. I just think, yeah, I've still got it.
Yeah, I've still got it. I know what you mean, mate. When I finished university, through my degree, I had one housemate who had an Xbox One. And I absolutely kicked the ass out of it. Around studying, obviously. But yeah, we used to have like, we played a lot of FIFA in the house. And like we'd have like apology, you know, like apology rules that were quite popular on Facebook. We'd make our own. So basically, if you lost 5-0 or higher, your housemate got to send a text off your phone. To anyone bar family or work.
Yeah.
And
that's an important
one caveat, yeah. And you had one black card so you could say no, don't text her probably most 9 times out of 10. Yeah. That was really enjoyed that. And yeah, when I finished uni, hit adult life, I spent probably like 6-9 months searching for a full-time career that I'd really like to do. And when I finally struck gold, I suppose, I decided, right now I've really focused on adulting for a few months now, I'd like to treat myself to a PS4.
Yeah.
And just regress a little bit. I think it's important, you know, like they say, work hard, play hard. You've got to be like a kid sometimes, even when you're doing the adult stuff.
Oh, definitely. I think gaming, and like some people frown upon adults gaming and think that it's such a childish thing, but it's such a good way to unwind, I think. You just come home and like whack on the PlayStation for a bit. Especially some of these games where you can like just jump in and out of. I've never been a big one for games like Skyrim or Assassin's Creed. And I know that they're great games and I do appreciate them, but I can't get into the story mode and everything quite so much. I much prefer just jumping on, playing a couple of games, coming off like 20 minutes later. So Call of Duty is perfect, and FIFA's a good one as well, actually.
Yeah. I think I like it just probably a bit of an opposite reason. I think I like reading books quite a lot, and I like films quite a lot. I think games are often just another good way of storytelling.
Yeah.
Except you're often the main character, which I quite like. But yeah, I just find it so funny. We start this podcast, and the first thing we speak about for a good 10 minutes is gaming. But yeah, when I think about it, is to be fair, you know, a great deal of what we bonded over was back in the day when
definitely
12, 13 year olds.
Getting all the quick scopes and the low scopes, and oh mate, we were on top form, and we had like a little. We would come home literally, and Ollie and Nick would probably be on already, and we'd jump on, get the headsets on, and go and jump on and play with them. It was wicked. Yeah, it was some of the best years of my school life.
Yeah.
But at the same time, as you say, I'd gotten nothing done, so I ended up getting, believe it or not, quite a few detentions in year seven because I didn't have my homework done. And it was literally just because I'd come home, play PlayStation, eat food, and then play PlayStation until bedtime. It is a bit of a problem, I think, nowadays with they've even come up with like a medical diagnosis for people who are like addicted to gaming.
Yeah, I saw that the news the other day.
You get therapy and stuff. I think some people are a bit skeptical about it and don't think
The problem is, having done it, I did my psychology A level, obviously it's not a degree, but we spoke about I can't remember the name of it, but there's basically an encyclopedia they work on and review each year of all psychological conditions. And having a brief sort of glance at that in my second year of A level, and looking at like the number of different forms of schizophrenia and the number of different forms of various mental health illnesses they've come up with, I appreciate, you know, as professionals, but at the same time, it's kind of like you get almost like when psychology was an emerging science, a group of the early psychologists had the opportunity to name their own disease almost.
Right.
So there was a bit of a gung-ho period, I think, where lots of diseases were...
What can we come up with get named after?
And I think it's a very, very fine line, isn't it, between, you know, sort of being a bit overboard and just saying, right, that is now, you know, a recognised mental illness, and that is, you know, just something that perhaps could be solved with a bit of good parenting.
Yeah.
But I think addiction as a whole is something that, yeah, needs to be taken seriously. Obviously drugs, alcohol, everything.
Sure.
And I think as a result of that, gaming has to fit in that niche. But how you diagnose people needs to be very, very strict. Because if you've just got someone that is just playing games and they go home from school and their parents
just enjoy gaming, because it is a hobby, isn't it?
At the end of the day. It's not like, you think everyone, not everyone, but the vast majority of people that I know would get a diagnosis of TV addiction.
Oh, for sure.
If you follow the same,
same protocol. Exactly. So exactly.
I can't see why addiction. Some people have been like, "Oh, this is rubbish."
Definitely.
Back in my day, we go and climb a tree.
And it's like what you were saying as well, with them just, you know, going out willy nilly and just putting all these disorders out there. I think some of the personality disorders are probably just types of people. And you know, they say everyone's on the spectrum of like autism somewhere, and that we all have our own little things that make us boil over, or you know, we're just different human beings, aren't we? I think.
And yeah.
You have got to be careful with stuff like that, and sometimes as well, people have blips. You know, if you're particularly stressed out, or you've had a you've had a rough time, or like, so, you know, some people must get diagnosed with like depression after a family member has died, I'm sure. But yeah. I reckon that's fair enough, and it's just grieving, right? Like you don't have to label everything as
as a medical condition. Actually, I think we just need to approach it much more like we do physical health. Like you got to think of some mental illnesses as cuts that we can put a plaster on and we'll recover in a short period of time. And other ones, yes, there are chronic mental illnesses where people will just sort of suffer recurrent episodes of the same thing. I think the closer we get to recognizing that, you know, having a serious bout of depression is like having a broken leg and you're going to need 6 to 8 weeks, or, you know, maybe a lifetime if it's a chronic case of, you know, medication or cognitive behavioral therapy, that sort of thing. I think the more we approach it as a physical health factor, the better it will be. And again, drawing on psychology at A-level, which I was absolutely buzzing about, I really did enjoy it, even though it was A-levels and they were pretty rubbish overall. I just find it really interesting when we did like the biological side of things, how different people's brains are when they're suffering from mental health issue.
You can see that through like scans and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. When they do CAT scans of various different conditions, you know, all sorts, they can recognise that there is a way that the brain works differently effectively when you're suffering from an illness. And I just think that ties in even more why we should treat it as a physical
condition.
Because if your brain is working physically differently, you've effectively got a brain injury and you just need the right sort of medicine to fix that.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because a lot of the stigma that comes along with mental health is because you can't see it. I had no idea that technically then, by the sounds of it, you can, using the right piece of equipment, you can actually then see someone's mental illness, right? So in a sense then, you know, the more we find out about the way that these present, the more we can actually get a good idea of who does have mental health issues and finding ways then that we can best support them.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think it's being pioneered at the moment. I'm sure there's plenty of more so the neurological, like neuroscientists as opposed to necessarily psychologists, or in fact, you know, the overlap between the two that are looking into it. I'm just thinking it's mad how we've gone from gaming straight into deeper mental health.
It's the beauty of
I'm going to bring it back to a bit of sport and fun. I did a degree in sport and exercise science, and one of the quotes I won't forget from my sports psychology part of that degree was, if exercise could be put in a pill, it'd be the most prescribed medicine on earth.
Hell yeah.
And that a large part of that was from the mental health side of things, because obviously it can help treat a range of mental illnesses, but obviously also the physical side of things with kids these days eating all the Mars bars.
Well, I heard literally this week that doctors have started to prescribe the park runs. As a form of treatment. I'm not sure what they were prescribing it for, or who they were prescribing it for. But I'm definitely, as a physiotherapist and someone that is a massive advocate for exercise, I usually take it from the standpoint of treating physical illness, like we were saying, but actually I'm definitely a big advocate for the benefits for the mental health, because all the endorphins that your body's releasing, all those happy chemicals that you get after you've been out for a run, or that you, when you've socialized and gone and played a sport with some other people. I know I come in feeling great. I like, you feel buzzing, and it really does pick you up. And I've seen a difference in myself in times when I've gone through being really inactive and then been miserable and then being really active and being full of energy and buzzing all the time.
Yeah,
I think it's just, it's kind of common sense almost, isn't it? But yeah, it's not.
No, I absolutely agree. I suppose there's a running joke with a lot of mates I play rugby with that the off season is sometimes the worst time of year. Not necessarily if you're like feeling down, but more like you've got a lot of bottled up testosterone and aggression, and you find little things that wind you up a bit more than they would during the season when you've, you know, you're meeting up with your mates twice a week, three times a week to train and play. And like you say, not just from like the health side of things and endorphins, but if you're playing a team sport, it's a social occasion, isn't it? You new friend circle and you're doing something that releases endorphins together, and that's only going to create, you know, like a strong relationship, I think.
Definitely. You played rugby at uni. Did you play for the rugby team for the uni then? Or
yeah,
was it just the training? And
yeah, so I played for the team at uni throughout all 3 years. We had two teams. It wasn't a huge university, so two teams. I played for the first team throughout the 3 years. Really, really enjoyed it. And yeah, great bunch of mates. I kind of lived at uni for the sport. Obviously, my degree was sport oriented, but
yeah, no, that makes sense, I suppose, doesn't it, in many ways?
I would say it was probably split into thirds: sport, social, and studying.
No sleep mentioned in there, by the way.
Didn't happen. Lots of sleep, but you probably speak to any of my uni mates, already slagged me off the amount of naps I took.
Serious?
And all that sort of stuff. Well, more so during my like dissertation period. This is really bad, but in like the fortnight leading up to my deadline, I would just, you know, when you just want to escape stress, I would just go to sleep during the day to not feel stressed about my deadline. Instead of sitting there and writing, I'd be like, oh, you know what, I'll do a late shift at the library and sleep from 4 till 6. How about that? I sleep from 4 till 6, then get up and be like, oh, should I go to the library? This, that, the other.
So 4 till 6 in the morning?
No, like 4 p.m. till 6 p.m. and then be like, I'm going to go to the library for like an all-nighter. And it culminated really in a night. Wednesday nights are like social night where you, after your sports game, which you play in the afternoon, you go out and celebrate in a fancy dress every week. And
you must have a wardrobe full of fancy dress.
Well, now. I say fancy dress, but I just spent a lot of time in Primark.
Right.
Doing like a DIY job.
Nice.
Most of the time, it's just buying a dress, to be honest.
Classic.
Yeah, we made the themes quite simple.
Nice one.
But you can get quite inventive, you know, like you come out of ways of making fancy dress work. But yeah, like I said, it culminated. My dissertation was due in about a week. And our house, with my mates who were a bit more on top of their admin at the time, had managed to sort of schedule in their workload a bit better. One of my housemates didn't have his dissertation due for a little while further than ours. My other housemate is about to study his master's degree. He's a little bit older than me. And I reckon he might end up doing a doctorate one day. You heard it at first. And then my other housemate, again, had a different deadline. They'd agreed to host pre-drinks based on that. And I said, not a problem, but I won't be going because my dissertation's due and I'm going to study tonight. And then promptly decided ahead of my night sesh, I'd have a little kip. And I woke up from my little kip with the whole rugby team in my room.
In your room?
But yeah, not all of them. Obviously, they can't all fit, but everyone had come upstairs, snuck upstairs and woke me up and dragged me out of bed and were like, go to the library.
And, did you go?
Yeah, I went. I was in a proper strop as well. I was like, for God's sake, that wasn't funny. I was just trying to see. And I got like 35 blokes in my house that were like,
to be fair, mate,
you're studying, why can't you go to Bob?
I'm pretty impressed that you managed to go to the library after that and you didn't end up getting dragged along with them, because that could have easily happened.
It could have. But the stick basically was that I'd already said, being captain of the team as well, that I wouldn't be going to the social in favour of studying. And when they found me at their pre-drinks asleep in my house, they were like, get in the library, otherwise you should be coming out. So
yeah, I can understand that.
That was a fond memory.
What was your favourite fancy dress from that era?
We once did a Tom Daly bop.
Tom Daly, so a diver?
Yeah.
So you literally all went out?
Just went out of a pair of pants, yeah.
Speedos?
Yeah. And it was a baptism of fire, really. That was in my first year at university. And as someone who, you know, 18 years old, just about finished puberty, just about getting comfortable with myself and that sort of stuff, suddenly you're walking through public areas in a pair of speedos. Because you've got to walk from, we lived in an estate. In my first year, I was in a house, and the estate was probably about a mile walk from campus.
That's a long walk to be. Yeah,
and obviously you've got pre-drinks to go to as well. Yeah, and I won't forget that night. But when you talk about, and I know it's quite like funny to think about, and people think it's silly, but being serious in terms of character development, you cannot, I don't think, grow confidence without putting yourself in uncomfortable positions and weakly walking up a main busy high street through Winchester in either pants or a dress or something else ridiculous really helped me grow as a person, I think. And it sounds ridiculous, but I wouldn't change it, because I think if I hadn't put myself in that position, there are situations like I find myself, or I think to myself as a 17, 18 year old, I don't know, talking to girls, for example, where I'd be a lot more shy than I am having done that for 3 years at uni.
I'm sure that gave you literal balls. I'm impressed that you went out, to be fair, like that, because while I was at uni, I wasn't part of a sports team for the first year, because my main sport is squash, and there wasn't a club when I got there. So in the second year, I ended up setting one up, and we ended up having socials and a few things here and there, but it was still a very small team. We were a very small uni anyway, so there weren't many of us, and no one was really keen for that kind of thing, myself included, in fairness. So that's something I'm completely missed out. I did, however, see all the hockey lads, the rugby lads, going out week after week in these ridiculous outfits, making a fool of themselves and but having fun, and we all laughed at them, you know.
Yeah.
They were lapping it up. They were loving it.
Yeah. No, exactly. I think you get a bit of bravado being in a big group like that, particularly like a hockey team and rugby team, where there's 50 of you. You feel invincible, like, and you know you've got 49 mates in the same situation
yeah.
that are also having a laugh. So I definitely think that group mentality is, I think, is a really positive thing. I think it can be negative. You've seen it in the press when rugby teams at a certain university go far beyond the line. But I think in the right amount, again, in terms of character development, you take a bunch of lads and there will be a top third that are super confident, probably too confident. There'll be a middle third of normal blokes, or girls if it's a girls' society. And there'll be a bottom third of guys that probably join a club because they've not experienced it before, or naturally shy, introverted, whatever. Join that team and get into that group environment. And I think it's just really good for them. It's what I quite enjoyed seeing some of the kids that turn up as freshers. And then looking at them now, having graduated, seeing them, they're effectively men now because they're graduating, and thinking how much they've changed since they arrived as someone who'd never touched a rugby ball, never really been interested in rugby, but wanted to be part of a group that without them realising nurture their confidence. I think it's a good
thing. Brilliant.
Yeah,
what role did you play as a captain then in that? Did you organise the socials, or was it more of the coaching and the organising of the tournaments and the matches and stuff?
Yeah, so in my second year, I took on a chairman role, which is much more like admin based effectively. A little bit of finance. We did have a treasurer. But the chairman sort of deals with sort of the running of the whole club. Forget the first team, second team, women's. You're trying to make sure that the club represents the university well, maintains relationships with sponsors, maintains relationships with areas that they train, that sort of stuff, the local community. So that role was a little bit different to the skipper role, because you're thinking, I guess you're a bit further away from it. You're not thinking just about the team. You're thinking about the university almost in a way, because you're trying
picture,
to think.
I guess.
Yeah. So I quite enjoyed that, but a lot of that was, you know, like making sure membership was in on time, deciding how much membership costs, that sort of thing.
A bit less fun than dressing up as ladies.
Yeah. Being captain of the first team, I would suggest that at my university, the first team captain is effectively club captain. I know lots of unis where you will have a first team captain, second team captain, third team captain, fourth team captain, and your sole responsibility is, you know, being with the team, making sure performance, keeping it going on the pitch, and winning the game ultimately. But for whatever reason, however it worked out, in my first year, second year, and third year when I was skipper, you kind of dad to the team, I guess.
Dad, did he say?
Yeah, in a way. Like, you're the first person that has a chat to the freshers when they arrive for their first ever meet at the training session. You give a little speech, go around asking them for a fact about themselves, and a funny sex story, that sort of thing. Nice. Baptism of fire, let them know what the pace is at, and it's going to stay that for the next 3 years if they stick with the team, that sort of thing. So yeah, as skipper, like, a lot of it was just, again, admin, like making sure kit was had and fixtures were sorted and we were getting there in the right place, and people that needed to reclaim fuel costs were reclaiming fuel costs, and the turnout of the training was good, and the coaching plan of the coaches that we had was streamlined, and making sure that those that weren't of the same ability as the first team, but obviously we all trained together, were still getting the most out of the session. It was more so from that point of view.
I've got a question quickly, because I know that when you were at uni, you were also part of the Army Reserves. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
And you've always done a lot of that type of, like, you're in the cadets as well, right?
No, so I wasn't the cadets. I never did anything military up until I was at university.
Seriously?
Yeah, but
I know you were interested in it for a long time.
Yeah, so my mum and dad are both ex-armed forces. And I went for a brief period when I was about 15 till I was about 17, where I was like, I really want to join. Well, in my head, I watched documentaries about the Royal Marines, and I was like, I really want to join the Royal Marines for a year or so. And then, and again, I'm going to sound like everyone's sub story in a minute, wait for it. Rugby became a slight possibility for me. And I laugh myself thinking about that now, but at 16 years old, I did have the opportunity to trial for a premiership club. And
so it's London Irish.
Yeah, so at Irish, I trialled for an ACE programme through my county where I played for Berkshire. And I thought, that's it, we're all sorted. I'll do 2 years at a college in Sunbury whilst also training with the Irish Academy. At the end of it, I'll get an academy contract. And then after I've got been in the academy a few years, I'll play professional, and I'm all sorted because I've, you know, I've got it all. Wasn't the case. I did injure myself quite seriously before the trial. That's everyone's story. In all honesty, I wasn't good enough. Right. And I didn't spend enough time in the gym compared to the boys that I now watch on telly that I've trained with as a kid.
That's not easy to admit that.
Yeah, I don't think it is, but
I'm impressed.
But one thing about work ethic, like I look at some of the, there are a few lads that made it that I'm quite quick to, when sat around a telly with mates in the pub or wherever, quite quick to say, oh, he was so average when I played with him at 16 years old. But it's not about that. You've all been selected for having something a little bit special. It's those that are willing to put the time in off the pitch that made it. And credit where credit's due, I now get to watch them on telly. Awesome. Which is...
Are they playing for Irish then?
There's a few. There's... I won't say names, not a name dropper. There's one lad who is a first 15 player for Irish, or was for the last 2 years, but he's just signed of another Premiership club.
That's so cool.
I played with him against Buckinghamshire in 2011, probably, like I said, when I was 16. And again, like, thought, yeah, he's sharp, but I wouldn't say out of the group of players, like, he's the best player in the squad. And then likewise, there were players that I thought, there was definitely a player at Berkshire that I thought, bloody hell, like, he will go all the way. And he hasn't. He's sort of second string at a club in Ireland. But again, I do still see him occasionally on the telly playing in like their the games where they have opportunities to trial youngsters. So yeah, like I say, there are a few. And like I say, if I'm being honest with myself, even if I hadn't done my ACL, I don't think I'd have been deserving of a place on the scheme.
Yeah.
And long term, if I had gotten the scheme, I wouldn't have got an academy contract at the end of it.
So just so everyone knows what you're talking about, what's your ACL?
Ah, Mr. Physio.
I'm not testing you here. I'm just, just so that people...
It's my anterior cruciate ligament. Yeah. It's one of the main ligaments that doesn't grow back. MCL and LCL, from my understanding, also don't grow back, but they're much harder to rupture. The cruciate ligaments rupture when you sort of land or twist or pivot or change direction with a lot of force, or plant your foot with a fully extended knee. Anything like that.
And, this man knows his stuff.
Yeah, well, I did a similar degree to you, sport and exercise science. And,
did you have anatomy in that as well?
So it's split into four topics. Well, yeah, three real topics and a fourth rubbish topic.
That was the same with my degree, to be fair.
So we had physiology, which touches on the anatomy side of things, biomechanics, which is quite physics heavy. You're looking at angular velocities, ground reaction force, that sort of thing.
That's cool.
Psychology, which I really enjoy, and research methods, which was just how to write an essay for those that had done BTECs and got to university. But yeah, my mates in our third year, we have optional modules, and two of my mates chose biomech. I am terrible at the mechanics side of things, and I really didn't enjoy it throughout second year, so I opted for an extra psychology unit instead. But when they did their biomech, they looked at injury prevention rehabilitation from a biomechanics perspective, and a mate of mine wrote an essay on ACL reconstruction and whether hamstring graft is better than patella graft.
Interesting.
Whether no surgery is better than surgery, that sort of thing. And I read a bit of that and thought, bollocks, because I've had surgery with my hamstring, and I know that some of the literature says don't have surgery or have patella surgery, whatever. I think absolute shite. I would rather have something there where it's supposed to be than nothing at all. And I remember exactly, because I did my ACL, and for 3 months it wasn't recognised. So for 3 months I did physio, and after 3 months it still felt shit. After surgery and 9 months rehab, the knee that I've had the operation on feels better than my healthy knee. And my dad used to say before trials and stuff, he said, remember, you've got a bionic knee.
Nice.
Cause, to basically make me not worry, because I did my ACL a few months prior to the Irish trial, and we turned up to the Irish trial having not had surgery but strapping it heavily.
So you still went then to your trial?
Yeah. So it's dates I won't ever forget. Basically,
do not the trial is done further.
The trial's done over two legs. So, because they know people will be nervous, because professional club, they're not idiots.
Yeah.
Whereas county, you get one shot. the club were like, no, we do two trials because we want to give people a fair chance to show their skill set. So you turn up to your first trial, if you do shite at that, you've got an opportunity second trial to make amends for it. I turn up to the first trial with a fucked up knee, but not knowing that it was my ACL yet. Then had a meeting with a consultant 3 months after I've been doing physio for a completely different injury, who tugged on my leg. And right, Steve will know this, anterior drawers test.
Yeah.
That's where you sit on the foot and tug, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was the Lachman's test where you extend the leg out fully, you hold the back of the ankle, make them go lax, and then pull up and away.
Yeah.
Up until that point, I'd only ever had anterior drawers test done. I got to the specialist consultant and he decided straight away after listening to me for about 30 seconds to a Lachman's test, and he pulled the whole lower half of my leg away. It was disgusting. It was disgusting. I've never felt anything like it.
That just makes me cringe. Yeah.
Because on the anterior drawers test, I don't know if it was just because I was nervous and tense my hamstrings and protecting myself. No one seemed to get any budge.
Yeah.
And that's why they were all pretty confident that I said an ACL. He did the Lachman's and yeah, it was like, and then he looked at me and said, and I just told him about Irish because he was a former Saracens player.
That's cool. And so he knew where you were coming from then.
He was 6'7", surgeon. Oof, his hands were like spades. How was he be trusted with a scalpel? I don't know. But having watched footage of an ACL reconstruction, I now do know because it's disgusting. And they just batter your leg with a hammer until they've got the craft out.
I can second that. I've been to see some surgery and it's brutal. Yeah,
it makes me feel sick thinking about
what
I went
through.
It
looks like a carpentry like office. they just have all these tools like hammers and screws and... Oh, mate. And they don't... You just look like a piece of metal or a piece of wood or something. You do get thrown around.
Yeah,
it was awful.
I watched it and disgusting. But he looked at me and said, you've done your ACL. That means there's no more rugby for you this season to avoid further damage. I will get you booked in for an MRI, but I'm also going to book your surgery anyway because I'm confident the MRI will just confirm what I've already said. And then I had a little cry.
I was going to ask how was that for you, considering you just made a decision? Well, you were working towards your potential professional career as a rugby player.
Yeah, he left the room for me and mum to have a little look. I had a little lip wobble, shed a few tears, and then pulled myself together. And then we talked about dates for surgery, and I had my op in February just after my birthday. But I also knew that in 3 days' time, I was going to have my Irish trial. And once we got home, I had a good chat with my mum and dad. And dad put it to me in the sense that I've been playing on it for 3 months, played for county on it, not knowing. This is a once in a lifetime. Go for it. So I did. Anyway, but like I say, irrespective of the injury, I wasn't good enough anyway, if I'm being honest with myself.
Okay. So going back to what I was going to ask earlier, I'm interested... What you found was more character building? Was it your time in the Army Reserves, knowing only a little bit about what you'd been up to then, or was it your rugby and your uni time?
Character building, I don't know. I figure lots of little things or big moments in life. So the 9 months of rehab for the ACL was character building. Because I had to get up before school at 7 a.m. every morning, cycle to my, once I could cycle, to the hospital, do my physio, go to school on top of my studying and that. To graft a project, being myself and my health for 9 months, was a hell of a task. And I think that helped shape me. Getting over the disappointment of not getting an opportunity of Irish shaped me. Having the chance to reflect and think, you know what? Even on my best day, there were boys there that had already played for England under 16s.
It must have been pretty sick.
They deserve a spot more than me. And when you think that there's 12 places, only two of them realistically are going to get an academy contract. Out of that 12 places, I wasn't going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
Realistically, unless I'd... I say that, but I'm now thinking about my own character. The reason is not because of ability, it's because of graft, basically. The guys that turned up there having already played for England, yes, they got a hell of a lot of talent, but they would get the contracts, I believe, because of the amount of hours they'd be committed to put into the gym, irrespective of training program.
They put the work in.
Yeah. forget that, like, you're also studying your A-levels at the same time and you've got your program. But I could see the boys that would make the contract being the ones that are willing to drag themselves out of bed earlier in the morning to fit an extra hour in, which at this point in life, and I'm working on it, I don't have that.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's why I've made peace with, as much as I talk about it as if it was a realistic possibility, I think I was quite a bit further away than I like to think I was from playing pro.
I think that's a spot on though, because a lot of people want to be successful at certain things in life, but I don't think most people are willing to put in the sheer amount of work and the way they have to live their life to get there. You know, it's especially applicable to sports, because like you're saying, you do have to put a serious amount of hours in to your training, to the gym, to your, like, to your physio as well if you have an injury, just to get a shot. And to, you know, you have to put your life on hold, don't you, essentially? And to a certain degree, when I was at uni, I'd got fed up of playing squash and playing week in, week out. And that, you know, I wasn't even taking it that seriously. I just found that I got a bit bored by after two years of doing the same thing, and still being fit and active. It was just, I don't think I would really have it in me ever to do anything close to becoming a professional squash player, just because I don't have that sheer motivation and drive to get there, really.
Yeah. And again, like, hindsight's a wonderful thing. I think about how much I dislike doing a bleep test, and I think if you want to be a professional athlete, you're probably going to do a fortnightly bleep test, maybe a weekly. Not actually a bleep test, more sports specific. I know rugby, we have our own RFU approved anaerobic fitness test, which is disgusting, much like the bleep test.
Disgusting. And I just think,
if you are, you know, your job is Monday to Friday, yes, I get to play the sport I absolutely love, but at the same time, when I get up at 7 on a Monday, from 8 till 10, you'd be lifting heavy weights. From 10 till 12, you're doing skills. And from 12 till 2, you're doing team runs. And then from 2 till 4, you're on the bikes, whatever it is. Then you go home. So you're only doing, you know, like an 8 till 4 day, maybe less. Maybe you get a shorter training period, or that last 2 hours instead of being on the bikes is a recovery session, whatever. But you know that each week you're going to get assessed on fitness. And I think, if I, having done the degree now and thinking I'd quite like to coach quite seriously, what kind of things I do as a professional coach, I would say, look, if you don't get past level 14 on the bleep test, you're not eligible for selection on Saturday. Because you can do that. It's professional sport. That's part of it. And I remember speaking to my sports psychology lecturer about this. He worked at a professional cricket club. And he said, yeah, everyone had a chart and you were colour-coded on your fitness scores. And if you weren't in green, you're not very likely at all to get selected in the match day squad. And he said there was like two exceptions in the whole squad, the old boys, the guys that were professionals at the end of their career in their very late 30s, who the coaches were willing to make an exemption for. But everyone else, particularly the young guns, fitness and basically graft was a large part of being eligible. And I know from running with my mum and the army, I think in a way the army is a good thing, because it teaches you to push yourself to the limits, and you've got no choice. You're in a platoon of people or a section or group of people, and you're being told, like, you will run until we say stop. And that's why I think that's a wonderful thing for character development. But I think if we're talking about a professional athlete point of view, where you are playing a sport in your spare time and you want to play professional sport, you have to have that self drive.
That self, yeah.
From a fitness point of view than necessarily the talent.
That's almost harder, isn't it? I think having to put yourself through utter crap just to get where you want to be, rather than, you know, and not having someone to push you and to, as you say, just to like absolutely beat the shit out of you to get there.
Yeah. Well, like you said, in terms of being self-driven, I think like personal training would be out of business if everyone was self-motivated.
That's a really good point.
Yeah. So
that's a really good point.
Self-motivation is clearly a rare thing.
Yeah.
And the guys that make you don't hear about 15-year-old lads. You might do, okay, if they're at private school and they're getting groomed for a professional club and they're going to play, they're on a certain path, yes. I think there's a few where daddy will pay for a session of Johnny Wilkinson, that sort of thing, and also pay to make sure you've got like a personal trainer gym. But I would say the vast majority of guys that make it are the ones that are willing to do that completely off their own back. And I think that's a rare talent.
Okay. going back to the Royal Marines, right? Because I've watched a couple of programs about the Royal Marines, and I know for a fact I'm not made for the army, and I'm not interested in that kind of thing even slightly. But the training fascinates me, and the discipline they have, and the drive, and just the mental strength and agility they have to be able to go through all the crap that they put up against.
Yeah,
I'm amazed. So impressed by it.
What I think is fantastic as well is that no matter how in-depth a documentary is, you cannot get a flavour for false endings in a documentary. Which something like Royal Marine Selection, they go through all the time, particularly on like field exercises, which again, in a documentary, you're not going to be privy to a huge amount of that, because there'll be a lot on tactics training that they won't put in a documentary, deliberately so. Because
you don't want to give the game away.
Yeah, exactly.
Really.
That exactly. You know, you'll see how stag works and people being on night shift and how far they're going to walk. And again, if you watch an hour episode documentary, they might say, the narrator might say, they've walked 30 miles today, but you don't get a feel for that in a 2-minute montage. And you also don't get a feel for right at the end of the exercise when this section of recruit Marines have just completed their final platoon attack for the day. And they're on top of a tour in the middle of Dartmoor in the pissing rain. And then an instructor walks up to them, taps one on the shoulder, says, well, finds the biggest bloke there. The one guy in the platoon who's 6'4", weighs 110 kilos, taps him on the shoulder and says, you're a casualty now, you've lost your leg. And then says to the rest of the lot, right, I know you guys thought we told you you're going to get a hot breakfast on top of the tour. No, you've got to carry this guy on a stretcher until we say you've reached the end point. Yeah, there's nothing replicates that. And when you talk about learning self-drive, until you've been through like false endings like that, you know, they talk about when you mountaineer, you get a false peak.
Yeah,
where the steepness of the hill.
Funnily enough, we have talked about that in our podcast.
Did you?
Yeah, because
oh, fantastic.
I think it was one of the first episodes we did, we talked about when me and Will went walking in the Lake District and we experienced that.
False peak, yeah.
And it is demotivating, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So what they'll do deliberately as part of any military training, Army, Royal Marines, you think the Army's premier regiment for infantry anyway is the parachute regiment. And they go through a similar process to Royal Marines. It's not as long, but I would argue it's more intense in terms of speed, shorter distances, but attacked harder. That sort of thing. They put them through that sort of thing all the time, where they'll say, you know, we're going for a 5K run, and then they take them 10K. You know, like, the principle, I think, is fascinating. Not knowing when your end point is, how much that impacts motivation, but also, like, how hard you'll work for the period. I had a really fantastic strength and conditioning coach at one of the clubs I played for when I was a youngster. He actually lectured at my university, and his phrase was always no sandbagging, and for him that meant no leaving anything in the tank.
Okay.
And I don't know if it was a military thing you took from that, but you know, not leaving any sand in the bag. But the whole principle was, when you are told to do an exercise, you do it as fast and hard as you can until you're told to stop. Like, no matter, because that's why they deliberately say stuff like, I had a guy called Simon who we do sprint shuttles with, and he would never ever tell you how many shuttles you were doing. Yeah, he'd just blow a whistle and you sprint to the cones, and then you know that once you've crossed that line you can rest until you hear the next whistle, and then you're sprinting again. And I just think that's a brilliant way to train and teach people, just to keep grafting, like, without needing to know when the end is.
I imagine something like that makes you realise actually how much potential you have and how much strength you really do have, because until you get pushed, like you say, out of your comfort zone, you don't know actually how much you're capable of.
Yeah, I went on an exercise in my last year at the OTC, the Officer Training Corps, while I was at uni in Salisbury Plains, which is just, it's basically used for artillery ranges a lot of the time. So it's very wide, open ground, hilly, lots of long, thick grass, and a few wood blocks. And that was, so being in the reserves, we often only go on exercise over weekends, but you think you're in the regular army, you're probably looking at the minimum is a 2-day exercise. Most of the time, you'll probably be doing a 4-day exercise. Or if you're in a kind of hardcore regiment, you might be doing 16 days in the field at a time.
16?
Yeah, whatever it might be. When you think in real life in theatre, like in Afghan, yes, they've got Camp Bastion, which is a nice place to get your head down, and you've got tents and aircon and all that sort of stuff. But when you go out to a forward operating base, that is effectively like being in the field for however long. And you might be in a forward operating base for 3 months before you cycle back to Bastion, yeah, get a week in Bastion, and then do the next forward operating base, wherever it might be, patrol base.
16 now, days isn't actually a lot then, really, considering what the
exactly,
might be potentially
exactly
needed to do.
So in the reserves, we're quite reserved. We at the time, we're lucky in the sense that they've only really got us for a weekend. So you can do a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and on Sunday you're going to be chin strapped. But at the end of the day, you've only really done
chin strapped,
well, knackered, tired, okay, on your chin strap. So okay, hanging out of your helmet because
yeah,
your head's
yeah, yeah,
weighing you down.
Yeah.
So
I like that.
Yeah. In Salisbury, we, he had us for a weekend, Saturday, Sunday, and we slept for an hour in total. Now that's pretty soft, really, compared to what regular soldiers would go to.
How for the 3 days?
Yeah, so Saturday, Sunday. So Friday okay, night, we arrived in the block.
Yeah.
I arrived late because I had to play a annual rugby match we do between graduates versus current squad.
Yeah.
So I played that, had a few gin and tonics, went to bed, got up at 5, drove to Salisbury to meet them for the morning walk onto the area. Arrived at Salisbury, got kitted up, got given my Bergen. The fuckers in my group put two litre bottles of water in the bottom of my Bergen. I did discover it before leaving. And I said, oh, what are these for? And they said, reserve water, right? And I just took it. I said, oh, really? Oh, okay. And it's partly because they'd have to pack my bag for me because I joined the exercise late. So right, fair enough, comeuppance.
But
after we'd walked all day to get to our first point where we got a chance to take our Bergens off, a lot of people had gone through their canteen, so I was like, I took it out and was like, right, who wants a refill? And the staff turned up with a jerry can full of water for refills, and I was like, oh, the staff, I'm carrying the reserve water. I just got absolutely mugged off basically by the squad. Quite funny though, but basically they then, when I got
it's
them
funny
out again,
now
because they'd seen
sure
me take out
the time.
Well, because everyone had been quietly whinging about how much graft we'd been doing, because we'd been walking non-stop since about 7 o'clock that morning, and this was when it was pitch black at this point, where we got to stand still, put our Bergens down in the middle of some woods, and I opened it up, was like, right, who needs water? And they were, and then yeah, the colour sergeant rocked up with a jerry can full of water and was like, right, water's here. And I was like, I didn't say anything, but I just thought like, oh, they've stitched me up so bad here. And then once I bought them out, the people that packed them were like, oh my God, we thought you took them out and left them out in the block. But I put them back in because I'm an idiot. But yeah, that was rotten. But yeah, 28 hours, 1 hour sleep total, because you've got to go on stag. And the commander that planned the exercise for us, fantastic guy.
What does stag mean or stand for?
Right, sorry. Stag is sentry duty. So no one can sleep unguarded. So right, if you're in a group of people, there always needs to be someone on guard.
Yeah.
And realistically, because it's an armed forces role, it's going to be lots of people on guard. You can't just have one person up while 29 people sleep.
Right. Otherwise you'll be fucked, yeah, 20, really.
Exactly. So you're going to have, often they'll do like night stag, you have to do it in pairs because you don't want people to get lost in the woods and you've not always got night vision. You can do roaming stag or static stag. Roaming's less secure, but easy to stay awake. Static is you'll be lying in a trench, already been knackered, pointing a rifle at absolutely nothing until the time that you do get attacked.
I can't imagine how you could even stay awake for half of the night.
I got some
lying down
as
well. There's
always great stories about people falling asleep, some fantastic ones. Our one of our captains, who was an officer who'd gone through the ranks, so he'd gone all the way from private, made up to warrant officer one, then went to main board and went straight in as a captain instead of having to do lieutenant. He told us when he, in his soldiering days, he once strapped a bungee cord, so like a stretchy,
yeah,
yeah, with hooks on the end. You've got like netting on top of your helmet.
That, out of everything, that's the one thing that you thought needed explaining.
Just for the listeners, you know? So, yeah, sorry. But yeah, he's put a bungee hook through the netting in his helmet and attached it to the tree above him whilst lying down on sentry, and then gone to sleep, but the bungee's held his head up, so it looks like he's awake. And one of the training staff...
To try
staff,
and cheat the system?
Yeah, yeah. So he's lying down, holding his rifle, just asleep, but because the bungee's holding his head up, so it doesn't... Like, if you fall asleep on a rifle, it's really obvious because your head will be, like, slumped over your rifle. He's fallen asleep with his head looking like he's aiming down the sight because he's got the bungee holding him up. And you're tired enough to fall asleep with a bungee holding your head up. And he told us one of the colour sergeants clocked him and saw him and was like, oh, my God. And he cut the rope. And, yeah, basically, the captain that was telling the story smashed his nose on his sight on the rifle. He said so he woke up rudely and, was pissing blood out of his nose, like, ah. And, yeah, the colour sergeant just absolutely, like, shat on him, was like, where you on stag? Well, because again, the regular army, not the reserves, but also the reserves, they still, you know, the whole point of the army nowadays, given how depleted the main body is, the reserves are interoperable. But if you fall asleep on stag, it is a massive, massive no-no. Like, you'll go to army jail if you do it in training.
Really?
Yeah. No, I say jail, and I always thought jail, like, they put you in a cell. It basically means you get physically beasted and, like, marched to and from jail. It's not like you don't get sentenced, but yeah, if you fall asleep on stag, you're in a world of trouble. Because
I suppose.
Exactly, because your mates are going to die potentially. But yeah, there are some fantastic stories. There's a documentary on YouTube, I recommend it to anyone, about Sandhurst, and there's a female officer cadet in that who gets called into an office for doing something bad by the training sergeant, and he says to his Welsh, she goes, do you know what you've done? And she goes, oh yeah, I fell asleep on radio stag. And he goes, you what? And she was in there for something completely different. And he goes, you fell asleep on stag. And he slams his hand down on the desk. The telephone comes off its handset. It's one of the funniest things I've seen because she stitches herself up so bad.
Oh, bless her.
He gives an absolute grin.
Awful.
But yeah, say so. Anything like that is a big no-no.
To drop yourself in. Yeah. That's so bad.
But to get to the point, we spent a long time walking, not a lot of sleep. It then started pissing down a rain in the middle of the night, went horizontal, and then we had to go out and do a recce, so reconnaissance. So go and look at the objective for the following day. Again, it's all training.
Yeah.
The whole point is to learn by being pissed on with rain at 3 a.m. And again, when you do a recce, some of the team have to stay in a certain position. And again, it's a lot of lying down still. In the pissing rain, but also being so tired that you're falling asleep on your rifle. And to get to the point, like, I was commander of the team at that point in time that were meant to be in this static position, and you end up saying stuff like, you all right, mate? And then you're not off for a bit, or you're not sure if you're not off, you can't remember.
Yeah.
And then as soon as you realise, oh, I'm going, you're right, mate, to the person next to you, you just got to keep a little bit of conversation going, otherwise you will, like, it's really, really hard not to fall asleep.
Sounds,
especially when you're lying still.
Sounds awful.
It's pretty rough, but that's the point. Like, not the point, but when you then go to do a late night session in the library at university, you're in an air conditioned, like, warm, you can have a hot drink when you want to. You're sat in a t-shirt and shorts.
That sounds beautiful compared to what you've just described.
Like, lots of people be like, oh, I did an all nighter in the library last night. It was grim. I did an all nighter in the middle of fucking nowhere and pissed on of rain. carry a load of kit. Like, I think it's brilliant just for teaching people not to be flannels. Basically,
I'd recommend it to anyone.
Speaking of which, I saw in the news today that France brought back national service, and but they've done a caveat with that, and I think it's a great idea because they're not saying that everyone has to go armed forces. You could do your national service through, like, voluntary work or charity work, and I think for those that are pacifists out there, that sort of thing, that's brilliant. Yeah. For that, anyone that's been to juvenile detention, get them in the armed forces, in my opinion. I even think if Britain followed suit, I think it would be great. But if we don't, I'm not going to be upset, but I'd recommend it to anyone.
Why should the juvenile detention people go into the army?
Because I think if you're on a path that might be towards a life of crime, potentially, I think the kind of experience the military offers you, whether they're rubbish or not, can often be a good way of setting people straight. That's not always true. There's plenty of people in the Army and the Navy and the RAF that are bad people, even though they're in. For example, sergeant in the Army tried to murder his wife by...
That's right. Yeah. That was there's bad people everywhere. The news recently,
there's bad people
it?
Everywhere. But I think if we were to bring a national service system in like France, where, you know, you've got the option of people that don't want to go the armed forces route to complete their national services in another way, I think that is a luxury that some people shouldn't be afforded. Like, yeah, those that have been juvenile detention for whatever reason, which I think it's a good thing for them, because it teaches discipline, it teaches self-discipline, it teaches work and work ethic. And then once you come out of it, I would say that if they did a statistical analysis over a long period of time, you'd find that those that had gone through national service from that kind of background went on to get a job, wherever it might be. You know, in my opinion anyway. It's not backed up by stats at all.
I must say, it's pure opinion, I'm definitely with you on the good bit, the good caveat there, where they say that you can go and do voluntary and charity work as well. Because I think you'd have such a good impact in so many ways, wouldn't you, with having that national service, where you'd get all the character building and the work ethic, but you could also have a massive impact on your local community and helping those that are really in need, couldn't you?
If you've got people doing national service by volunteering at a homeless support shelter, it's a win-win.
Yeah.
They've got to do it. They're contributing towards the nation, the whole point of it. And whether that's through the military or through other means, I think it's spot on. So it's one of our topics in my first year of the OTC. We had to deliver a lecture. I didn't choose this particular topic, but one was, should national service be brought back? And yeah, I think there are some countries, like Israel, for example, where you do full-time military job for a year, where I think that is, if you think of everything on a spectrum, that's an extreme of national service. But I think if you were to ask people to, I don't know, commit to the Army Reserves or any reserve unit where all you're doing is committing one night a week, much like a sports club, and the occasional weekend, like maybe one weekend a month where you're on exercise. And if you only have to do that for a 6 month, 12 month period, in terms of actual hours of you doing the service, it's not a huge amount.
It's not a lot. 52, isn't it, essentially? Then what's that in terms of the grand scheme of things?
Yeah, but you've learned a lot and contributed in some way.
Yeah. Do you, as part of the Army Reserves, are you able to get just called up if war breaks out tomorrow?
Yes, from my understanding. I found out today, so I've got a job with the police, and I rang them up today to find out about my HMRC form, because I was looking at, do I need to tick I have one job, or do I need to tick I have another job, because I'm a reservist.
Yeah.
And they told me, because of the nature of the reservists, he said if it all goes pear-shaped and World War III breaks out, in the police we need to ensure that we only have a certain percentage of reservists, because you could get called up.
Yeah.
So that would be my understanding, yes.
Okay.
In the OTC you can't, you're non-deployable, but elsewhere you can.
Because I guess then if half of the police force is made up of reservists, then war breaks out, then you've got no police officers to like crack on with.
Yeah, exactly. That's what she was getting at, effectively. So yeah, it's a fine line.
What made you choose the police force?
Basically, there was a graduate scheme advertised. I heard it on the radio, and I had a little look for it as well. When I was exploring options
again,
after university.
It's not a career path that a lot of people look to doing because it's not easy.
Yeah,
you have to deal with a lot of shit and a lot of horrible people in the world.
Exactly. I don't know why I put myself through it, really.
Yeah. So, good question.
Again, well, tying back into everything, I personally think I was going to get onto this, going to get heavy, Stephen.
That's cool.
Mind.
I'm down with heavy.
All right. So,
as long as we don't get weighed down for forever, it's okay. We can go a little bit deeper for.
When we talk about being born,
10 minutes or so,
it is a complete lottery, isn't it? Like where you're born. So, I'm lucky enough to be born in the south of England, an affluent area. And have most shit provided for me. You know, I've been able to go to school, grow up, not get stabbed, going out, walking in my local community, that sort of thing. And I count myself very lucky for that. But again, it's a lottery. Like, I was just lucky that I was born. I had the parents that I did. Could quite easily been born in Yemen. They're currently going through one of the worst famines in human history, because they're getting bombed constantly and there's a civil war. I think, and again, we're talking about core principles, I think I owe not the luck of being born, but the place that I've been born, for being able to grow up in relative safety. I owe a service to that place, whether that be through the military or through the police. And it doesn't have to be a service for life. That's what I'm keen to point out. I've always said to myself, if I was to join the army full time or do the police, anything like that, I would give it 5 years. And at the end of the 5 years, while I'm loving it, I will stick to it. You know, I probably will love police work, and I might do my 30 years and retire at 52. But likewise, after 5 years, I feel like you've done a contribution towards the place that has given you a bit of luck or a bit of a head start. And I think on the flip side, if I had been born in Yemen, I think the good ethos to have is to, I think lots of people say this, leave Earth a little bit better than you came into it. So if you're born in a shit place, yes, you might not get to national service, but just try and do something, you know, for the good of the world.
That's beautiful.
So the opposite end of the scale, where I've been lucky enough to be born in a nice place, I think it's just important to give something in Definitely. Some way for however long. Where, like, the scheme of one's 2 years, I could leave the police after 2 years, but
that's cool. It's not, you definitely aren't signing yourself up forever then.
Yeah, no, exactly. But I just think the role I'm in is community focused, so it's neighbourhood teams, and the whole point is helping out deprived communities. They throw out a few stats. So, for example, if you are a child born to parents in social housing, you're 37% more likely to commit crime.
That's a lot of percents.
Yeah. There are a few more. I can't remember them from the video. I recommend having a look at the website if you get a chance, Police Now. Police Now is the scheme. It's only graduates, because I don't know if you're aware at the moment, if you want to join the police through sort of the standard route, you have to go to college and do a certificate of knowledge of policing first, which comes at your own expense and obviously takes a bit of time. Once you've got that, you can apply to train as a police constable, but again, you've then got to pass their recruitment process.
It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get through.
Absolutely. So you might spend £3,000 on a course, or however much it is, spend a year doing it, and then be told you're not good enough. Which I can imagine is a massive kick in the teeth. But basically, a couple of detectives in the Met, I only know one of their names, David Spencer, because he's the CEO and co-founder. They thought at the moment, particularly with the police being absolutely strapped because of some certain decisions in the current government, they thought we're missing out, with the focus on counter-terror as well, we're missing a percentage of the job that we need to do, really. Like, I know that we're short of detectives by 5,000 across England and Wales. Yeah, 5,000 detectives short. And only 5% of burglaries are currently being solved, or ending in a conviction, I think was the stat.
Holy crap. 5%.
And I think that's awful. Like, I've been fortunate enough to grow up.
It doesn't give you a lot of faith, does it?
No, that's only burglaries. But again, I've been fortunate enough to grow up in a neighbourhood where we've not been burgled, but I know the impact that has, knowing that someone's been in your house while you're asleep, or even worse, has woken you up with a knife or whatever it might have been. That's fucking terrible.
Yeah.
And then to find out that the really nice detective that comes and meets you, because of the lack of resources, the lack of CCTV, the lack of forensic availability, cannot convict the person that did it unless they are a known repeat offender. And don't get me wrong, the guys within the 5% across England where they get arrested, it will be known drug addicts that are feeding a habit, for example, because it's without a CCTV, you can still, if they've not got an alibi, you might be able to get a conviction based on circumstantial evidence. But the fact that if you've got like an organised crime gang that are doing serial burglaries and serious burglaries of affluent areas, the fact they're not getting solved is worry, isn't it, really? And it's partly because we're 5,000 detectives short across England and Wales.
I would say as well that probably is one of my big, like, my worst nightmares is like waking up and knowing someone's in the house. And I would probably feel paralysed in that situation. I would literally be in, I'd probably just try and stay asleep.
Yeah.
Even thinking about it makes me
nervous. Yeah. Absolutely. It's not right. Horrible. It's like someone has invaded
in
your privacy.
Safe space.
Yeah, exactly. Home is supposed to be, now, again, not to make you feel bad, but homes aren't very, like, if someone really wants to break in, they're going to break in.
Oh yeah.
They'll put
a
flower pot through your window.
Not that
but
secure,
the principle
really,
should be that, you know, the police and the repercussions of that should be a deterrent, but that's not necessarily the case at the moment. The Prince of Police Now, that was founded by this chap David Spencer and a colleague, two detectives in the Met, was to pick up on the shortfall their experience where graduates aren't joining the police, and put them in neighbourhood roles in that community focused job where you're trying to build confidence in policing in the community and also reduce crime. So that's the role and that's the focus, and I'm looking forward to cracking on with it.
When do you start?
July. So
sick. So next month.
Yeah, 22nd.
Fantastic.
That's training. But
well, I wish you the best of luck with that. I'm really excited to see how you get on and hear some more exciting stories.
Well, yeah,
if
I come back on the show, I'll tell a few stories.
For sure, man.
We'll see.
It's always so interesting talking to you because you've got so many stories to tell from your rugby and your all your interests and passions about the army and stuff.
Everyone's I don't shut up.
It's good, man. You're the perfect guest. Someone who comes on and just rattles on and just loves what they talk about. It's so good. And I always learn new stuff that every time I speak to you. So I knew as soon as I'd started this podcast, I knew you were someone that like I had to get on and have a chat with.
Well, to be honest, I've been glad to have been on. Glad to have a chat. I've enjoyed it. It's nice to have a catch up. And like I say, some of the topics we talked about, quite passionate about. And hopefully, like you said, it'd be nice to come back at some point after a bit of time in a job like that and let you know how I feel about it.
Definitely. And your passion definitely came across for sure. It's been really good to have you on. Yeah. And so I'd like to thank you and thank Will again for being the producer and the audio man. It's been so nice to be out in the garden again and having these kinds of chats. So thank you guys for listening, if there is anyone at the other end of the podcast. And I hope you can join us in the next episode. Take care of yourselves. Goodbye.